Stan Deo has held above top secret security clearance and worked undercover for the FBI, and he's been part of an exclusive black project headed by Dr. Edward Teller, specializing in the development of flying saucer technology. Stan's diverse background encompasses computer program of mainframes in 7 languages, PC and Macintosh, senior systems analyst, research physicist, both formally and self-educated, marine architect, self-educated, advanced propulsion engineer for marine air and spacecraft, author of 2 books and 6 scientific papers, partner in Deo Industries Enterprises, LLC, and R&D, web hosting, book publishing, book distribution company for the last 30 years. And I think what I would like to do is, if there's anything else you'd when I started looking at your bio here, it's really quite lengthy. So what would you like to let the audience know a little bit more about yourself, Stan?
Well, Melody, lengthy is not necessarily super, but anyway, I've done a lot of things, as you pointed out there, and I suppose the latest thing that's probably not up there because I haven't updated it yet is we've started this new company here in Colorado called Halo Orbital Technologies. It's Halo is put together as an abbreviation for several factors, high altitude and Lorentz orbits and various other things, Lagrange orbits, sorry. The mnemonic or the, I forget what you call it officially, my wife is the English expert, but it's an abbreviation for all those things that makes Halo out of it. And then Orbital Technologies, it's our new propulsion company here. And the idea is to develop a civilian form of the flying saucer technology propulsion that I developed and was exposed to under Dr. Teller's guidance, or his group's guidance in Australia. What I'm doing is trying to make about a 25 to 30 foot diameter saucer craft for individual or 2 individuals to use that would fall into the ultralight category, if we can just keep our weight down. And it will use off-the-shelf ducted fan and fans and various other control mechanisms. So I'm spending a bit of time doing that and getting the prototype ready to fly. We have an engineer helping us over in Oklahoma. He's doing the remote control access. And we have engineers here in tooling, mechanics working on various parts of it here in Colorado at Canyon City and at Penrose. And trying to coordinate all those guys while we're doing our book business and trying to finish 2 or 3 papers I've got going on the true nature of gravity and the way the universe works and a few other minor things like that. So, and some experiments that we're doing on measuring an electrical variation in the gravitic field of the Earth. We're doing experiments here and in Australia to compare the results in Northern Hemisphere and Southern Hemisphere. So is that kind of enough at the moment, Melody?
Yeah, because I was watching a video on some of that information, and you could do one of the best explanations for the anti-gravity mechanisms. I don't know how else to explain it. You're much better at that. But as far as I wasn't aware that you were really trying to develop it for the average person, then is that what you're?
Well, Melody, can you turn your volume up just a bit?
Okay.
I think you asked me, can I explain how it's being done for the average person? Is that what you said?
Yes.
Okay. Well, let me be clear on that. There are 3 different types of saucer propulsion that I'm aware of. 2 of them I would not release to the public because it would not be clever, because people will get hurt. They're very dangerous to even play with. One is true anti-gravity. Another is a hot charged air drive, which is called a plasma drive, and that had a lot of problems when it was developed in the mid 50s and early 60s. That was something that I also came up with in 70, about 10 years too late. But it the one I'm looking at is built upon the same principles of the smoke ring propulsion system, which is, it creates what's called negative drag. and it pulls itself forward rather than pushes its way through the air. And this is a lot safer for people to use, and it will certainly take you further on a tank of gas up there. It'll take you about four times as far at the same speed because of the unique drag recirculation that it used. And we try to teach people the theory of it by teaching them first how smoke ring works in the air, and then secondly, more advanced concepts, taking a water hose and a 5-gallon bucket out in the garden and showing them some tricks there that explain how it all works to create a vacuum in front of the craft. So that's the kind that I'm developing for civilian use, because I feel it is safe and nobody would get hurt. But the anti-gravity one that you saw in the video, that stacks up energy invisibly, but it stacks up energy in a dynamic spinning electromagnetic field. And let's say you had a Volkswagen hooked up to an electric generator powering the coils for that one I was talking about in the show, and you ran it for 30 minutes. Well, it would store up that energy for 30 minutes. It doesn't go anywhere. It goes into a spinning field in and through and around the craft and the crew. And done improperly, you can release all that energy, which is like a 65-horsepower motor running for 30 minutes. You would have 1,800 times the energy of a 65-horsepower motor if you released all that in just a second. So if you can imagine that, it's a very powerful explosion should you accidentally convert that field. And it is easy to do that. So that's why I figured it was just unsafe and unwise in the current terrorist climate to make public certain things that could be used against us or could hurt people if they tried to play with it improperly.
Well, Stan, do you want to get into a little bit on how you got into this and you know, your background is, you know, where you're training and grew up and that sort?
Well, I was raised, went to high school and grade school and everything in Dallas, Texas, and went off to the Air Force Academy for a couple of years and came back to Dallas and trained at IBM to be a systems analyst and also in 1401 and 360 computer operations. Went to work there as an impossible mission guy to take my crew of people around to various large corporations who had troubles with their mainframes and solve their problems and straighten out their payrolls and employees and whatever. But that was my daytime job, and I built a lab there in my house there near Dallas at Mesquite and started researching ultrasonics, sonics, plasma drives, and the way I got turned on to this new kind of propulsion was having to water the garden one day out there. It's kind of sandy loam there in Texas, and I was bored to tears watering all this stuff with a hose. And I guess you've probably done this too, but when you shoot the water from your hose down into sandy soil, it puddles up and it's almost like quicksand, and you can put the end of your hose in that hole you make in the dirt, and it'll start to suck itself forward. Have you ever done that?
I have.
Okay. Well, being bored, I was standing there doing this, and I thought, wow, that's interesting. Now, until I put that hose nozzle down under that wet dirt, it's kicking back at me with a force like a rocket. It's a little water rocket on the end of that hose there pushing back toward me. But if I put that nozzle head down into that wet dirt, it sucks itself forward and tunnels in. Why? And so, the wife caught me out there a couple times. Instead of watering, I was digging holes in the garden with this hose, saying, oh, look at that, isn't that neat? And repeating the effort until I realized I could do it in a 5-gallon bucket of water so I could see what was happening. And in the bucket of water, I was able to see that the water went down into the bucket and hit the bottom of the bucket and curled around and formed an invisible kind of smoke ring in the water out of water instead of air. And the more I studied that, then I realized that we could do that with magnetic coils using what's called MHD or magnetohydrodynamic propulsion, which is a long way to say use direct current magnets pulsed at the right frequency to move charged air around them and around the shell of the saucer craft to produce this flying smoke ring that is constantly replenished by what you're pumping into it. And that's a plasma drive, the second time I kind of was talking about a while ago. So anyway, I was pleasantly pleased with myself about this, and at work at one of my clients there in Dallas. I was solving an impossible mission with my team there. We've been there a year solving the problems. This conglomerate had 100 companies in a large conglomerate there in Dallas, and all owned by one guy and one computer system with a staff that tried to put, in those days it was hard to do, but they did put some Trojan horse viruses into the mainframe, and we had to find them. And one of my helpers there, assistants, found it something like 8 hours before they were going to power up the computer the next day and wipe out the employee records of 3,000 employees.
Oh, boy.
So anyway, I was there, and they'd give me a very nice office, you know, with carpets and couches and blackboards and a secretary and stuff, and up on executive row, and because they were quite pleased that we'd pulled them out of that mess.
What time frame is this?
Oh, this is back in 1970-71.
Okay.
And I had lunch. I had a coffee break. I took a coffee break whenever it felt like it, but it was about, I don't know, 10 to 10:30-something in the morning, and I went down to the bottom floor of the building into the cafeteria that would hold probably 1,000, 1,200 people, and I was the only guy there, which was great because I didn't like to jaw a lot, and so I got a cup of coffee and sat down, and door opens down there at the cafeteria, and this guy comes walking in. I recognize him as one of the vice presidents of one of our companies there. And he came over with his cup of coffee and sat down right in front of me. Of all the tables there, he decided to come sit and talk to me. And I didn't know him, but I'd seen him around. And he starts to talk to me about, what was I doing. And, I was doing some research at home and wanted to know a bit about it. So I mentioned some things about what you and I have just been talking about. And he says, you ought to go see a friend of mine. He'd be real interested in that kind of stuff. And he gave me this doctor's name, and I said, yeah, look, I'll get around to it, and put it in my pocket and forgot about it. About a month later, I was down there doing the same thing, only person in the whole cafeteria, and here comes this guy again. And he sits down in front of me, there's a table, and he says, look, I told you to see my friend, and he says you haven't contacted him. I want you to go. I've made an appointment this afternoon, about 3 o'clock. I want you to go over there and see him here in Dallas. So I said, oh, well, I'll see. He said, no, it's important. You go see him today. I mean it. So I went, and to make a long story short, this guy was an associate of Dr. Edward Teller's on this project to develop flying saucers. And we had a secret meeting there in his office, and he showed me a few pictures of them going under the polar ice in a submarine, and him getting champagne poured over him as part of the initiation. And that was when they were going to some of our bases down there. And they told me about how they've been working on anti-gravity and plasma drives and that kind of stuff for several decades before I'd come along, and they wanted me to join them, come down to Australia and finish my research down there. And they made all the arrangements with the Immigration Department, State Department, and things just kind of moved real quick when they picked up the phone and asked for favors, and suddenly I was there in Australia. And my control agent there was Captain Sir John Williams in Melbourne, and he had a file about half inch to three-quarter inch thick on me before I even got there. But that started then the long trek into developing flying saucer technology, seeing what else they had, and then having a disagreement with the organization because I found out they were part of a much larger political organization, which some people call the Illuminati. And they tried to put me at the bottom of a mine shaft, and I escaped, and wrote the first book, The Cosmic Conspiracy, to explain, first of all, the technology, and then how I'd gotten pulled into it, like we're talking about here, and then why I was telling people as much as I did about it. I withheld a number of things, and that's one of the reasons we had a kind of a Chinese standoff there, so that they didn't totally sink my boat, and as long as I didn't go too far with what I released, they let me stay alive. So.
Okay, now you're saying this all took place in Australia then?
Yeah.
Okay, and...
Well, my part of it, they had bases in Norway and New Zealand, England, West Germany, Saudi Arabia, about 120 miles out of Riyadh at Jabal Tawake. Anyway, sorry, go on.
So are you saying that this was a private company?
It is a multinational, or it was a multinational company or group. We had, our guy was Edward Teller. Dr. Edward Teller was the head of our project for the American contingent. But in Russia, who was also part of this, at least in the scientific community, the head of their equivalent to teller was Dr. Andrei Sakharov, and they had him under house arrest for a long time. Couldn't even go get his Nobel Prize because of what he knew about the project and the technologies and, you know, the little gray critters that people talk about.
So you're saying this was all done before the end of the Cold War then?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay, all right. So when they acted like they were getting together to do joint projects, they'd actually been doing this for quite a while.
Well, yeah, and when you say they, these guys are above government. These are, even above politicians, especially. They are industrialists, they are bankers, they are scientists, engineers, and you don't go and say, I want to volunteer. They come and pick you. If they want you, they bring you into the organization. And their whole objective, on the Western side of it, the Judeo-Christian side of it, was to set up a global New World Order. And they had a few problems to solve, which they didn't manage to solve. And the organization kind of got replaced or taken over in the late 70s. And most of the guys that I worked with are now past of old age or other things that happened to them.
But there wasn't one to kind of come in and step forward and take over for them?
Can you just say that a little bit louder?
Okay, was there a group or organization to come in and take the place of those that were in the one you said is no longer?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. You'll probably kind of roll your eyes back at this, but I'm pretty sure that it was beings that have been on the planet before man was. They've been here for a long time, and maybe they left for a while, but they're back. In the Pentagon, it was kind of a joke or a password to say refer to them as the Sumerian gods, based upon the stela that have been found in the ancient Sumerian digs, talking about the gods that came through the eye and various other things to deal with mankind at that time. But I think those beings are here for a number of reasons. I don't think I've met any of them personally, but they were mentioned inside the organization. And according to inside information there in the group, they made contracts with them or agreements, treaties, and they reneged on them and took over what we had built underground in multiple bases in the late 70s. So I think that's probably how we lost control of some of our best underground industrial complexes. They're here, and you're gonna hear about it soon.
But I've also, I've read a book like Report from Iron Mountain and various other sources that have spoken of that a false flag event being tied to that. What do you think of that?
Melody, are you asking
okay.
a question?
Yeah, I am.
Okay, Iron Mountain, and there was a whole lot of what?
I was reading in the Report from Iron Mountain, which was written back in the 60s, about a possible alien attack being fomented or whatever, and uses a false flag event to create your one world government.
Yes, I wrote about that in the Cosmic Conspiracy too.
Okay.
Well, now that was the plan. That was originally the plan of these founders. People refer to the Majestic 12, and I think it was due to one of the special orders. I think it was out of the White House? 512, I think it was. Anyway, it formed the group, and Dr. Gordon Gray was kind of the central focus for all this. Became the Secretary of the Army around 1950-51. And this group of people realized that we did have alien critters here from the Roswell incident and from another one in 43. So what they thought was they would hold us back because they didn't want to take it to people and say, look, we've been invaded or these are our creators or critters or whatever. Just after World War II was over and people were very tired, beaten down from fighting each other, in Europe and Japan and the Pacific. And nobody wanted to go back to war, especially with something with so much technology they could never equal it. So they thought, we'll keep this to ourselves. It's a good plan. What we may do is let things leak to let people know that such a possibility may exist and that we're covering it up, which will allow us to develop technology to combat these critters. This group had proposed earlier to make an artificial event like you're talking about. The Iron Mountain Report was late, probably 10 to 15 years after the original event was discussed. But they were looking at engineering, economic, weather, and technological crises, and cash crises, and alien crises. That was the last one. To bring people to the knees globally so they would accept a new world government. But they got their plans interrupted by these aliens in the two incidents I talked about, in 43 and 47. So anyway, the MJ-12 was set up to address that, and they didn't have to make a fake or false flag thing for that because we had a real problem, and it was bigger than them as well. Now, it was known when they started talking about this before they had contact with the real alien critters, that the only way that we were going to bring a peaceful group of people together on this planet and have a one-world peaceful order and economic order and all this kind of stuff, the only way they had to do it, they could do it with, was to threaten the people of all the countries, all the religions, with a bigger, badder guy than anything they've ever seen, and kind of mysteriously so that they couldn't, people couldn't figure out ways to try to fight them or you know, get around them. It's like when you were a kid and you had a brother or sister in your room with you. You had to share a room, and you would talk and giggle and maybe even fight a bit at night between you before you'd go to sleep. And your dad would yell out from the other room, "Hey, y'all be quiet in there. I'm going to come in and I'm going to bring the bell." And, of course, you'd keep on messing around or calling each other names. And so all of a sudden the door would slam open, and here would be the shadow of your dad with this big 8-foot-long, 2-foot-wide meat cleaver hooks on it, belt, and says, "I'm going to kill you." Well, then suddenly you'd be friends. And they were going to use this kind of an approach globally to get capitalist, socialist, Muslim, Catholics, Christian, Jewish, all these people to forget their differences because they were faced with such a common, huge energy enemy that they were going to have to combine their energies to make a resistance to it or deal with it.
When you first heard all of this, how did you react to it?
I laughed, really, because I thought they were pulling my leg. But no, it sunk in. And I realized that later on, several months into the organization down there, that these guys had real power. I mean, they told prime ministers and presidents what to do. I personally had to be involved in one phone call to a deputy prime minister there in Australia, telling him to go to a certain meeting with Dutch Shell Oil and get him out of the shower. So I know, it's not hearsay, I know they had tremendous power over these people. The politicians jump when they snap their fingers.
Okay, now you're saying the Illuminati or the alien? I'm lost a little bit here.
Okay, sorry, the Illuminists, yeah.
Okay.
When I looked at it and talked to them and sat back and thought about it, what our Western Illuminists are doing is they're still fighting the Crusades. When Saladin the Great defeated the last of the Crusaders, and I think it was the 13th Crusade over there in the Middle East, the Western Crusaders went home and, you know, with the tail between their legs and apparently quit. But this whole effort they've been doing is toward taking over the Muslim lands over there and the oil, and that's the reason that they haven't released, our Illuminists haven't released a lot of the free energy stuff, is because they wanted to burn the Arab oil up so they had nothing left to sell. I mean, we've got plenty of oil capped off in the North Sea and in Australia and Alaska and here in the United States. And obviously we don't have a lot of extra refineries. I think we've only got about 8,500 left at the moment. But what they were doing was fighting the Crusades. It was the Western Judeo-Christian groups against the Islamic groups. And they figured if they paid them a high price for their oil and consumed it all, burned it up in our cars and industry and whatever, then they'd have nothing left to sell but sand, and that wouldn't let them have enough to be a threat, and that economically the Western powers would take over the Islamic powers and eventually head for China. That was their grand plan, but it didn't quite come to completion. In fact, really nowhere close to it. But that's what their objective was.
And is, I mean, because some of the documents that I've been reading, it sounded kind of like, I mean, this has been planned for quite a while. So even going way back, maybe the 20s?
Oh, this global New World Order was first discussed in Bavaria by Adam Weishaupt. He's given the credit for starting the Illuminist movement in Europe. And so, yes, certainly in the 20s, in the 1800s, and in the late 1700s, all this was fomenting.
I guess what I was talking about was the Middle East part of the takeover.
Ah, yeah, right. Well, we didn't start using oil until about then when the Ford Motor Car and a few others started consuming. But that's when it started. And the Arabs got wise to this. I think probably in the middle 80s, 1980s, there were a number of places they had to put their money to invest it because they just had money piling up in stacks and nothing to do with it. And so the Western guys encouraged them to join the World Bank and to fund emerging countries in South America. And, of course, a number of these emerging countries were then overthrown by your military aggressors from within their own ranks, of course, stirred up by various intelligence agencies. And the banks couldn't collect on the notes because the juntas that took over killed the economy, killed the notes, and all the loans that they'd gotten from the World Bank didn't get paid back, and so the Arabs lost their money. And it was a way to take the Arab money and lose a bunch of it and say, well, look, it's out of our hands. It was those South American countries that we invested in, and sorry about that, but you lost your investment. So the Arabs got wise to that, and then they started buying into Western companies in Europe, United States, and share markets and proxy purchases, and that's where a lot of their money is hidden today. But for a while, they didn't know what was going on, and they started playing with the big boys who handled the banks, and big boys took them in the first part of the game. But now then it's their turn, and they're certainly coming after the United States in a big way, and I guess I can understand it. I don't like it, but I can understand it.
Katie, do you have any questions here on this? Or? Whoops. Okay.
Well, this is just amazing information. How prevalent are the Illuminati currently within our own government? I mean, you said they were, like, prime ministers and presidents would jump whenever they spoke. Are they in our government?
They're not. Politically so, in the main, and in fact, I don't know how many of them are still left, but I could name a few of them that have been in high positions, like in the Defense Department and the State Department. In fact, they still advise those areas as well, but some of them have done me favors, some of them agree with what I wrote in the Cosmic Conspiracy, and were on my side amongst their own, against their own people. They took my cases, the right action, the right course of action to tell people as much as I did. Otherwise, I wouldn't even be back in the country, because when I started trying to release this information to these, about these people, my passport and U.S. citizenship were taken away, and I was locked in Australia for 30 years.
Wow.
But again, without saying the person's name, it was one of these guys still in an influential position that got my passport back, my citizenship back, and passports and citizenship for all my children born down there. So they are still around, but I don't think they're quite the organized group that they were in the past. There are fragments of it in Europe and in the emerging European Union. I think that you'll see some of the old money groups still forming over there, but I don't think the American contingent is going to be a very strong player in it very shortly, if at all, even now.
Who do you see will be the strongest player?
The strongest what?
The strongest player.
Who do you see will be?
Oh, that's hard to say, but there's a position rather than a person that I'm looking at in the Western European nation. They have a guy that has the power of, or a position they've created that has the power to make war for the European Union, and he's really like the secretary underneath the president of the union, but he has more power than the president of the union. I think at the moment Javier Solana holds that position, and the resolution in the Western European documents to set up this position, believe it or not, was resolution number 666. And that fellow, that position, whoever holds that position here shortly, and I don't know whether it's going to be Solana or who replaces him, because he's not in good health. But that position will give the guy in Europe extreme powers to mobilize a lot of nuclear and other military force to go into the Middle East and perhaps effect a temporary peace settlement. So that's what I'm saying. Watch that position. It may be filled from Spain or one of the other member nations, but I suspect it will be from Spain, and you know, we'll wait and see. Now that position, he'll have that position, he'll have that power, but behind him will be others as well, who are large moneyed, old moneyed interests, who are merchant bankers and various other kinds of conglomerates that are controlled by families, and they will back him, whoever takes that position. So that's why his position is so powerful.
So when you were sought out by this group, what is it that was outstanding that they that brought their attention to you?
Well, that's a good question. The only thing I can attribute it to is that they looked for this the vice president I was telling you about that I met at that company at Coffee Break. He or one of his associates looked in my office on the backside of my flip blackboard. You know, I could flip it over and do company business, and at night I could flip it over and do Stanley's business about, you know, equations and propulsion systems. And it may have been that somebody rolled that board over when I wasn't there and looked at it, or it may have been that he just picked up from my coffee conversation that first time. I don't know. But other than that, I have no idea how they found out what I was doing. But they even knew. When I talked to Dr. Maxfield, who was the guy he sent me to, he even knew what I was doing in my private lab at home. And I just didn't really tell that to a lot of people because I wanted to patent it eventually. So how they knew, I don't know.
Did it make you nervous that they knew without you having given them the information?
Well, a little bit, but what was more intimidating was sitting there with a guy that had degrees past his name, you know, a few of them. It worked with the father of the hydrogen bomb, and had built flying saucers and knew about anti-gravity, you know, to the nth degree already. And they were asking me to join them, thinking, I didn't even finish my degree, and why are these guys even talking to me? You know, I felt intimidated by that. And then, as you say, I wondered in the back of my mind, you know, if they know all this and have peeked into my lab and whatever, is this all a giant ruse and I'm going to disappear shortly? You know, I mean, there were a lot of questions going through my mind, I grant you that.
So can you explain a little bit as to why you ended up breaking away from them once you had joined this group?
A couple of things. When I first arrived, I was riding in the Mercedes with Sir John from the station there, the train station, where I came in from where we'd taken a house. I came into the city of Melbourne and met with him. Well, his driver and him were in the front of the Mercedes, and I was in the back seat with the luggage and stuff. And I heard them talking between themselves and to me. They were just mentioning about how their stock exchange down there was so good and everything, and it's because they didn't let any Jews on board. Well, I didn't say anything, but my father was Jewish, right? So I figured, well, if you know everything, you'd know that. And so I didn't bite and didn't say a thing. But as time passed, I realized that this part of the organization anyway was not terribly keen on having association with Jewish folk. And also, they were holding back technologies that I thought we should have given to third world countries to give them water and power in the remote areas and to help them control their birth rate and get food. And I knew these technologies that it would help. And they did not want to do that. They wanted to let natural attrition take 100 million people here or there by disease and starvation. They've even considered withholding grain loans to India at the right time, and they could kill 100 million people at one hit. And I saw that document. I held it in my hands and read it.
And what time frame was this?
Oh, this was back, 74 or 5, something like that, right in that area. I took it out of a satchel handcuffed to a courier from the CIA. So I'm telling you, it was it was real.
And do you think they're still doing that?
Oh, I don't know anymore. I don't know who controls our government. I really think that they're about to sink America because they've taken our technology, stolen our patents, taken our manufacturing away, and we're just kind of useless eaters to the world order now because they're going to swing the balance of power to Europe. So now I think we're done here. It's depressing, but that's the way it is. I think America's going to go down. And
what time frame do you see this happening?
Let's see. What time is it now? 9:30.
I think by 11.
Look,
I mean, it's going really quick.
Well, it is, and I who knew it was coming for 20 years, am looking at it now and saying to the wife and close friend, I can't believe it's going so fast because it is. I mean, I expect our economy to take a huge hit this year, and the American dollar to just sink like a rock. Against the euro, you're going to see this, and it's either going to be late this year, September, October, somewhere in there, or early first quarter next year, and I'm reasonably certain this is going to happen. I'm also of two minds about the value of people putting away gold or silver and stuff. To a point, this might be clever for a short time, but we're going to have tremendous famines and food shortages and gasoline shortages because of expense. And people are going to want the gasoline, they're going to want the food, not the money. They want what the money could buy, and there won't be anything, even though they've got gold and silver. And this is, kind of a contrary thought to what a lot of the investment people are saying. Get gold, get silver, get coins, stack them in a corner, and that'll take care of you. But, you can't eat gold and silver. You've got to have what it can buy. And if it's not there, whether it be fresh water or whether it be food or, energy, you can't buy it. Everybody have gold and silver, nothing to buy with it. So this is a serious concern. That's why Holly's book, the Dare to Prepare book, is so popular at the moment. I mean, our business is probably triple what it may, no, even quadruple at the moment what it was last year. People waked up in May this year and started getting her book and started forming clubs and discussion groups about how to help in the neighborhood and within their families. We're having people order the books 100 at a time. It's just people, just ordinary people. First responder schools are using it as textbooks. And it's 544 pages of getting people ready and saying, get the stuff you're going to need to eat and the water and the medicines and the radios and all this kind of stuff. And fuel, get that now and put it away so that you've got 6 months to a year of goods in some place. And we're telling people how to do it and how much of this and that they need for what age persons in their family and what sex and, all that kind of stuff. This is our effort to try to help the Americans that are listening and preparing how to do it correctly and quickly, because we just are almost out of time to be able to buy a lot of these things at a price we can afford. I mean, look at your food prices. A lot of them have gone up 25% already this year. And after the floods and stuff in Kansas and Illinois up in the Corn Belt, we're going to have increased corn prices, which corn and corn syrup are in everything, lipstick, candies, everything. So you're going to see this, and then ethanol, being used for biofuels is going to chew up a lot more of our crops that we could have eaten are now going to be burned in our gas tanks.
Well,
we're in real trouble.
But this would also affect the rest of the world. Do you get orders from other people outside of the country?
It could affect the rest of the world. I'm sorry, I didn't.
And you get orders from people outside of the country?
Oh, yeah. Today we just packed up a bunch for Ireland. We've got some going to South Africa next week, to Australia, Netherlands. A couple of others over in Europe that have done it as well. I mean, people all over are kind of thinking people have internet, certainly are starting to realize they better get their act together. There was this evangelist we saw on TV here on The Dish the other day, Perry Stone, and he was talking about dream visions he'd had about, the famine coming and the price of fuel going through the roof, and he was advising, wisely I think, his constituents to add 20% to their food budget every week and get a little extra food every week. Not all at once, but just 20%. Just get a little bit more this week, and then the next week, And then a month go by, you'd have almost, 5 weeks go by, you'd have double the food you'd have a month ahead. And he said, just do it gradually. Don't go out and go crazy because you'll impact the supply-demand curve. But he said, just start getting it now, a little bit at a time, and put it away. And I think that was very wise, as opposed to telling people go out with four SUVs and a trailer and load up at Sam's Club or something and clean them out, because that's just not going to work. It caused panic and shortage of stock all over the country. So,
and what do you think's behind it? Do you think this is by design, or do you think there's a lot more behind it?
Part of it is because of plans that people have tried to execute in various governments and groups. We have technologies that, since the early 70s. It's been known that we can control weather in various regions. And then as it developed, we could control weather and earthquakes in larger and larger regions from further away. But now, there are three players in this, major players anyway, the United States, Russia, and China. And so everyone having this technology, if they try to use it, certain types of it, without telling the other person, look, I'm fixing to bring you some bad weather, then all of their technologies start to operate and conflict with each other and produce skewed weather that none of them could have predicted. That's just their movement. But we have, since 1991, we've had another problem with the sun. Even if we did nothing, the sun is starting to emit two new spectral frequencies in the ultraviolet range. They aren't cancer-producing, as far as we know, but there are phytoplankton in the South Seas, south of Australia and around the Antarctic, that are absorbing these wavelengths and making the oceans heat up, and they're breeding more and more of these phytoplankton, and they are absorbing more of this UV. And it is increasing global warming down there. This is not to mention the fact that the sun at the moment is very shy or very low on sunspot activity when it should be starting to show more than it is in this cycle. It's though it's holding back, for a real big surprise. We could see coronal mass ejections, these halos of plasma coming from the sun, and they may hit us directly. A few years ago, they did that and hit up in the northwest United States and Canada, and they were blacked out for 2 to 3 weeks because it blew the power lines everywhere and started fires. So the sun its output is varying. It's a variable output star instead of a stable or steady-state star as they originally thought. And since 1991, we've been seeing this increase in that particular wavelength. The Hopi Indians have invited Holly and I down a couple times now to talk with their elders, and they are getting ready for the near future sometime, they just say soon, when the sun will be very hot for 2 to 3 weeks at least, and they'll have to live underground because it will be too hot to stand on the ground, and the roads will melt, and trees and grass will burn from the heat of the sun. So this does speak to the sun doing something unusual, and certainly it is acting unusual at the moment, and we're all kind of holding our breath to see when it's going to really get bad. But you'd have to be blind to not seeing the climate change happening around us. Massive flooding in certain areas, drought. I mean, Australia is getting killed by drought, and it's going to get killed by drought for several years, probably a couple of decades to come. It's absolutely just being wounded. And, the third world countries, India, Bangladesh, they can't afford to have any more sea level rise because a lot of the population just disappear. I have to swim to the nearby country for shelter, or dry land. So the machinations of people trying to harm other countries or groups, combined with the natural effects of the sun doing its thing, are creating havoc on the planet, absolute chaos. And there's a growing weight of amateur astronomers saying that the Earth is slightly tilting. It's moving more toward the vertical of its axis rather than the 23.5-degree normal inclination to the ecliptic plane. This may indicate a polar reversal coming, which may be both the surface of the Earth and or the magnetic core of the Earth flip-flopping. The sun itself reverses its magnetic field every 22.5 years in the Hale magnetic cycle. So we may be doing the same thing on a longer frequency because we're not as massive. All these things coupled together, man's stupidity and the natural course of events of the sun and its effect on our environment are driving us into a time of cataclysms.
Do you have a positive outlook on this, or?
Well, I do. I do. I mean, I'm not cutting my wrist or anything like that. I mean, you've asked me. I'm going to tell you, we're Judeo-Christians here, and simply because my heritage is Jewish, I've got a Jewish perspective on my Christianity. But I believe in the Messiah, and I believe the writings of Daniel the prophet and the revelation of John, and I've studied at length these things in Hebrew and English. And I see that what we're seeing around us was all predicted quite happily, quite clearly, a long time ago, thousands of years ago, and there's a happy outcome to it. Everybody on the planet doesn't die. The bad guys are caught by the God of gods and his people and the Messiah, and the earth is put into a golden age for 1,000 years. But before that time, the next 7 to 10 years sometime here, I suspect we're going to have some really horrific times so that people will understand what it's all about and will actually confess their allegiance to the God of gods and to the Messiah, who will be the new king of the planet. So I'm also of the group that has read in the scriptures where a group of believers will be taken out of the earth just before things really get bad in what's called the rapture by the Latin Vulgate, but basically it's something that was forecast in the Torah and in the indirectly by various examples that were given there. And having seen that pattern, we know that there will be a group of believers living and alive, alive and dead, who will be raised up, who will be taken off the planet to a place of safety during this time. And I don't know whether it's into a parallel universe like it appears to say, or whether it's to a place outside the planet in orbit, I don't know. But it just says up to a meeting in the clouds with the Messiah. So I personally am not distressed by these things. I have made preparations for my family and my friends, so has Holly, and we do this together. So that if we're wrong and we don't go any place, well, then we've made provision to take care of our people as long as we can and to endure until the Messiah does come. So that's why we're not really that distressed about it. I mean, it's not comfort zone to think that the crises like, World War III and super droughts and famines and horrific plagues and all that kind of stuff is going to happen. But, we're going to mitigate that through our understanding of what's written there, the warnings for this time. So.
Have you always believed along these lines?
Pardon?
Have you always believed along these lines?
No. No. Actually, I didn't believe this way when I was a member of the group. I was talking about Teller's group down there. When I left them, and I pulled quite a sneaky exit so that they couldn't track me. I was taught that by a guy I met that was former Australian security anyway. I'd gotten out into the Nullarbor Desert, been away from them for 4 or 5 months, and I'd just come through a little town, Adelaide, probably a week before, and this little old lady at a meeting I was sitting at there, a public meeting about UFOs or something, she shoved a little Bible in my pocket as I was leaving the meeting and says, "Young man, I think you ought to read what I've underlined here, and I know you got to go, read it when you get to where you're going." And I ended up one night sitting in front of the car headlights out in the desert and reading this, what this woman had shown me in the Revelation 13, and I realized quite a few things were no one knew about except me and the people doing it were in there. So I made my peace with our Creator there that night in front of the headlights of the car, and since that time, almost instantly, within days, miraculous things started to happen in my life, and I've never gone away from that since then.
So did any of your technology really get applied, do you know?
Well, when you say my technology...
I mean the technology you were working on.
Yes. Yes. Before I even joined the program, when I was still in high school, they were working on some of the things that I later developed that they recruited me for. And it's better they recruit me rather than shoot me. But anyway, they had plasma drive craft in the late 50s, middle to late 50s, in the United States. The SEALs caught fire on them around the top cupola of the saucer craft, and it would it created problems for the crew, and they had to ground the saucer and somebody else come get it. But yes, they had that then. They've built a number of them during that time period. They also built just normal aircraft versions, which were the early tests. But when they started to update and refine these plasma drive craft, they found out they would go so fast that turning corners produced such G-forces on the crew and the craft that it would break things and kill people. So they then had to figure out a better way to change directions without causing structural fatigue to the crew and the craft. That's why they were so glad to find anti-gravity, because it makes a dynamic feel go through the crew and the craft all the time. And when you change the dynamic vector of that field, it changes the vector of all your atoms together almost simultaneously, not quite, but almost simultaneously. And this allows you to turn corners at 20,000 miles an hour without feeling it. Although you get slightly heavier and time dilates, but other than that, it's not like you see in the movies where the jet pilot's face falls down to his knees and stuff like that. It's not like that. You can have a cup of tea and play a game of cards while you turn a corner at speed because time is dilated. So, yes, they have applied all these things I'm telling you. They have their own power sources, which are thermionic converters that will convert infrared heat, body heat, solar heat, anything, straight into electricity. And that was one of the things I wanted them to release to the public, you know, to help people. And they just didn't see it that way. And that's where we kind of parted ways. But anyway, the technologies of that have been used and developed within the groups. I'm also in agreement with them at this point because of terrorism and a lot of nutcases around. I don't think it is wise to release that technology over the Internet or the equivalent of making public anywhere. I've had a lot of young engineers ask us. They've been playing around the edges of it, and I've given them general information, you know, probably enough that they can prove various points but not build a craft, because I don't think it would be prudent to give the circuits and the circuit parameters to the public right now. It's just unsafe.
Well, thank you very much for doing that, because it's very important that we don't put knowledge that can hurt us all in the hands of someone who wants to hurt us all.
That's it.
You know, that's just so very important.
Could
you elaborate on this dynamic field?
The anti-gravity field.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You said that there was a dynamic field so that they could make the sharp corners.
Yeah, okay. Well, I suppose that's an interesting topic. I'll certainly explore that for you. Gravity, first of all, I'm going to try to explain that to you in fairly pedestrian terms because I want you to understand it. Let's take let's make a little imaginary room that's got four walls, and we're going to put a little trolley track from one side, one wall, to the opposite wall. And on that trolley track, we're going to put a little trolley with four wheels, and it's wooden, and it's got a flat top on it, but it's got one straight-up board on the end of it facing the opposite wall. And we're going to have a hole drilled in the wall here so that we can take a fire hose and shoot water on that vertical piece of wood on that trolley, kind of like a water sail. And we're going to shoot it on that piece of wood and force that trolley over to the other wall, flat up against it. Can you visualize that?
Yes.
Okay. So we turn on our fire hose. We accelerate that trolley by shooting the water on that vertical wooden member at the end of it. It goes along that trolley track and snug up against that wall, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now we're going to bring the trolley back to the starting point over on this wall here with us, and we're going to drill a bunch of big holes in it. Now we're going to shoot the water at it again. Now some of the water is going to hit wood, but some of it's going to go through the holes, okay? So now then, our trolley is not going to accelerate as quickly to the other side because some of the water is going on through. But as it approaches the other wall, there's going to be some of that water that got through the holes reflecting back and pushing on the wood, pushing it back toward the wall where it came from.
Mm-hmm.
So the result is, as you're pushing the water on that vertical wooden sail that's got holes in it now, it will go over close to the next wall, but it won't hug it because there will be a reflection of energy coming from the water getting through the holes, hitting the opposite wall, bouncing back on the backside of the sail, and holding it off. Now, you can just leave it there in that steady state, firing water on it from one side and having it sit maybe 1 foot off of the other wall, not get any closer, not get any further away. And you can reach down with your magic hand now, and you can grab that trolley and force it back to its starting point or halfway there and let go of it. Sure enough, it'll fall backwards over toward that 1 foot distance from the other wall. Or you can push it toward the other wall 6 inches and let go, and it'll fall back this way 6 inches to where it stops at that 1 foot distance from the far wall. Gravity is like that. You have energy spinning out from the planet or the sun or anywhere you have gravitational field. You have energy spinning out into the ether of space, reflecting back and falling back onto the planet in various places in a very orderly fashion. And so you have some energy accelerating particles of mass away from the core of the gravitational field and some accelerating it toward the core. And the happy distance, the neutral distance where these forces equal, forms a shell or a surface. And that's when we have a surface of a planet or various layers within that planet of more dense metals or elements. Now, by studying what makes gravity, then you can generate a field that makes counterspin to that. And there's a way to build that with electricity, and which I did show in that film as far as the coil structure, but not about the circuit and how it has to work and what frequencies and various other things.
Can I stop you just a second here and say you're listening to KHEN LPFM Radio 106.9 Salida, Colorado, community-supported radio, and support for KHEN and TruthQuest brought to you by Kevin Barnes, agent for Land Properties Incorporated, Little River Ranch, offering beautiful land home packages with underground utilities and river access just 3 miles from historic downtown Salida. Find out more at coloradohomeproperties.com or call Kevin at 719-207-0858. And I have Katie O'Brien, my co-host with me this evening, and our guest is Stan Deo. Okay?
All right.
Okay, so you can make a counter field with electrical with a coil.
Yeah, one or two or several.
Or several, yeah, with coils.
Yep. And now, I'm going to try to explain this. Now, a lot of people have heard that Einstein said that you can't go faster than the speed of light. He said, as you approach the speed of light, your mass becomes infinitely thin, and that time starts to dilate for you, to stretch out.
Correct.
Now, the reason his equations give that impression is because of a mistake that he accepted as fact, and that was from the Lawrence Fitzgerald equations to show foreshortening to explain the Michelson-Morley experiment, which tried to find if light was slowed down by shooting it in the direction the Earth goes around the Sun at the same time half of it is shot out at right angles to the Earth's travel around the Sun. And since they could find no change in the velocity of light using their mirror systems, Michelson-Morley decided that there was no ether space, there was no inertia in space, in essence, no dark energy, no dark matter, and therefore they had to explain other phenomena, and that's a phenomenon, and that's why Lorentz, Heinrich Lorentz, why he set up a series of transforms that Einstein picked up. And it's like 1 minus m squared over b squared, or b squared over c squared, which is saying mass gets thinner, time dilates. That's the transform, the Lorentz Fitzgerald transform. That was plugged in to explain other things that said that there had to be an ether space, but there wasn't because the light didn't change velocity. Well, all that's fine. That occurred before 1920. In 1925... Michelson and Gale used a spinning disc about 1 meter in diameter, and they were able to shoot light, half of it in the direction the disc was spinning and half of it against the direction, and they were able to show that light does change velocity. It will go faster than itself in space if you use a rotational framework like that. Now, having said that, Einstein's equations were great for the time they were in. You'll notice that there are hundreds of people at the moment trying to write papers to show the unified field theory to solve the problems that cropped up after Einstein died, and they found out that, you know, his equations didn't answer everything correctly. There was something wrong in the structure of his equations. The wrong in it is that there is a very fine structure, a sea, in essence, in the universe, full of energy, very fine particles. And these particles are what Maxwell and his people would have called ether space. And now then, they're called either dark matter or dark energy or both, because there's a large amount of mass unexplained, unaccounted for in the universe, according to latest data. And the physicists are all going crazy trying to say, where is this mass? We can see the gravitational effects of it, but we can't see it. And the lens effects and various other things. Now, because of that, where was I going with this? What were we talking about?
We were talking about the counter field.
Okay, yeah, right. Okay, because of this the fact that we can go faster than the speed of light, I understood that some time back, then I tried to figure out how the gravitational fields formed, and I figured out how they formed, and every gravitational field that we know of, whether it be an atom, a subatomic particle, a planet, a star, a galaxy, a galactic cluster, all of them will not have any gravity at all if they don't have spin. And, decades ago, astronomers figured out that they could look in their telescopes and look at a very distant star and say, we know what the gravitational constant of that star is. Not because they were close to it, but because that star in their telescopes wasn't perfectly round. It was squashed a bit. It's what they call an oblate spheroid. It was squashed. The poles were closer together, you know, and it was fatter at the equator than it was through the poles. And that was because of the centrifugal effect as it spun. And they figured out, I think it was on the sixth power of the angular velocity or something like that, that would determine what the gravitational field of that planet was because of this oblateness. They could just visually see it. Again, spin. So nothing has gravitation or gravity unless it has spin. And that tells you right there that if you have to have spin, then you have spin in something or relative to something. The whole universe runs on spin. Look at spiral galaxies. Look at barred spiral galaxies. Look at globular clusters of galaxies. All of these have a spin component. And when they started in the what's called the Big Bang, they came out and started to migrate into various differences and directions and attitudes. And so they're all in topsy-turvy arrays. We're looking at them now. But they all had an initial spin, let's say a right-handed spin, and then they started to precess and flip and turn and relative to each other and form galactic clusters and then galaxies and then planets and atoms, of course, are all part of this substructure as well. They formed before the planets did, obviously. But anyway, all these things have to have spin. So to have a gravitic field, to make an artificial spin, you have to determine a way to make a circuit that will spin the ether space, that very fine fluid that goes through all of atoms and all of matter. Katie, if you were to take your body and compress it 1,600 times, then the atoms would start to get close to touching, but not quite. So you're very porous. We're all matter around us is very porous. And even though you can't, you know, sense it with your fingers or whatever, it's as though we were popcorn 1,600 times, you know, our atoms 1,600 times further apart than if they were touching as corn kernels. We're exploded. You're very lightweight things in the universe. That's why fluid goes through us, this ether space, and we never even know it. It manifests as gravity or inertia.
In your video on anti-gravity, your use of water really made a very graphic way of understanding this fluidity with antimatter. Do you want to explain that a little bit? Or
are you talking about with sound, how it made the little bubbles form? Or
right.
Okay. you can duplicate this experiment. You can take a radio speaker and get a signal generator to make about 100 to 150 cycles per second, and put a speaker down on a table, and put a Coke bottle, one of these 2-liter bottles, about 3/4 full of Coke there, and I guess screw the lid on so it doesn't spill. But anyway, turn your speaker on and vibrate the table up and down, which then vibrates the Coke bottle up and down, and you'll turn your signal generator through a range of frequencies which will match that table and that Coke bottle, whatever they are, but it will definitely be under 180 cycles per second. Anyway, it will vibrate the Coke, and it will vibrate it at a certain frequency to craziness. You'll see just tremendous turbulence inside the Coke bottle at a certain frequency, and this will start throwing up spheres or droplets of Coke up into the air inside the Coke bottle that will then fall back down on the surface. And if you turn your amplifier and your signal generator to that frequency and cause this tremendous chaos to shoot these little spheres up in the air and then lower the frequency suddenly down to, say, 100, you'll see that the chaos stops and that little beads of Coca-Cola, little spheres making indents in the surface of the Coke, will just speed around all over inside that Coke bottle on the top of that layer of Coke. And, you know, traditional wisdom or physics says that's surface tension holding it up. But they don't really understand that it's not that. What you don't see with freshwater raindrops doing the same thing in puddles on the street during a rainstorm, and with that Coke droplet that you form with a speaker, what they don't see is that those drops of fluid are spinning vertically up and then down around into the core of them, and they have a vertical spin component or going up or a spin component going down, depending upon how they were created when they were thrown off the surface. And they're spinning so fast that the surface of the Coke becomes hard like a wall to them. They can't penetrate it. And these curling, spinning balls of Coke float around, spinning at high speed on the surface of the Coke bottle. And if you don't do anything except create them and then turn off the speaker, within a few seconds, they will sit there and then suddenly pop and disappear into the Coke and be gone. But at certain frequencies, which I showed in the video, if you tune it at the right frequency so that ripples are going out toward these little spheres from the side of the Coke bottle, what will happen is the little ball will stay there indefinitely. It won't go away because it's absorbing energy from the frequency coming in through the Coke bottle from the speaker. And that's allowing you to replenish the energy of that fuel instead of it running down. But that's why stars nova and blow apart. If they're not getting replenished by neighboring stars' energy, then they will spin out, and at a certain point, their surface tension, if you wish to call it that, will bust, and they'll fly apart and be part of the debris of the universe.
So essentially,
and a number of other things too that happen in novas as far as nuclear reactions, but basically, it's akin to what happens to that drop of Coke or water, and it's an experiment. You don't even need a speaker to do this. You can take a plastic ruler, put a 2-liter Coke bottle in front of you, about 3/4 full, and thump the side of that Coke bottle right about at the fluid level with a plastic ruler on the edge, and give it a sharp snap, and you'll produce a bunch of these little spinning balls. And you'll see some balls that will group together and hug together before they disappear. And you'll see some balls that will come close to each other and suddenly just bounce apart and repel. And that's because their spins are opposite. And we show that again in the video, where one little created ball or sphere on the surface of the Coke comes sailing over toward the others, and bang, it bounces off, while two others of the same group stick together. And that's because their spins are complementary.
So that's kind of explaining how galaxies form. Is that correct?
Yeah, atoms, subatomic particles, solar systems, or stellar systems, and galaxies, and groups of galaxies.
So it's not really that accidental. There's certain forces there that create that to...
Well, we laugh about it, but we say that it proves that God was right-handed.
Does this have a play into your antimatter technology? Or does it?
Sorry, does what?
Does this have a play into your antimatter technology, or does it?
All right, do you mean antimatter, not anti-gravity?
I'm sorry. anti-gravity?
Because we can, I mean, you can make antimatter by, well, yeah, perfect make antimatter. Antimatter is an opposite spin in every vector to what the particle itself is normally spinning. You have to take the particle itself and knock it out of its space where it's sitting in ether space. You have to knock it over several diameters distance away quickly. And if you do it quick enough, with enough energy, it will leave a hollow spherical cavity with opposite spin to what it was doing, and that becomes the anti-spin of that particle. And if you then try to force them together, they will annihilate and release a lot of, you know, energy in various wavelengths. But anti-gravity itself, yes, you have to have spin and containment to get your craft to lift up or make a skyhook or whatever.
Now, when you were talking about turning corners and whatever, it seemed like you were also getting, in your video, getting to the point of, it almost sounded like you had slowed down time.
Yes. Yes. You can't cheat physics. There are operational laws for our universe. And so what happens is if you concentrate a certain amount of spin energy in a very small space, that becomes the energy density becomes greater. If you release and spread out the energy over a greater volume of space, then that lowers the energy density of space in that region. Now, for time to pass, atoms have to react to each other. Things have to age. A tick-tock of a clock has to move this way or that way. A cesium atom has to raise its energy state and lower it. Something like that. Something has to move, change position, for physical chemical reactions to occur to tell us that time has passed. Time is nothing more than a ratio of distances. It's a unitless factor. Now, coming into a turn, you have two densities of energy. You have that outside the field and that in the core of the field. Now, in the core of the field, where the crew is, the energy density in relative to people outside the craft, the energy density looks like it's less. And, is that right? Let me think a minute here. I'm just trying to think. It's been many years since I explained it that way. But the energy density outside on the ground is different than the people inside the field in the craft. And they're going to turn a corner at very high speed, which means to turn that corner without suffering the inertial damage, they have got to amortize or stretch out the shock of turning that corner over several seconds or minutes so that their bodies are not, you know, hurt by this, and their atoms are all, you know, held intact without the G-forces. So as their energy is increased, to them inside the craft, looking out the window at people on the ground, the people on the ground go into slow motion, almost frozen, relative to these guys moving very fast in the field. To the people on the ground looking at the guys in the field, they're moving so fast, if they could see inside the craft, that they couldn't believe it, they'd just be a blur. Now, you could break out the cards in a cup of coffee as you're turning a right-angle turn in one of these craft, because in the equation, either time has to stretch out, or you get the G-forces, which break your body. So you stretch out the time over which the change in G-force occurs, and that actually is changing the energy density inside the cockpit and the craft itself, which allows you to live faster than the people on the outside. That's why a lot of these true gravity craft don't just kind of lazily turn a corner or stuff like that. That's why they go zip, zip, zip and do sharp turns. It's because every time you do a turn, you're aging quicker than everybody else by several minutes, and it adds up. And it's a bit of a pain in other ways as well. But that's the relative time factor. Your equation has to balance in physics, and something has to give. You can't just magically turn that corner without sacrificing either time or inertia to structural fatigue. It's like, you know, when you went to the fair years ago and they had these spinning barrels, you know, like a big can with the top cut off, and it was just a spinning vertical barrel, and you'd stand up against the wall and it'd start to spin, and then the bottom would drop out, and you'd be held against the outside or the inside wall of this spinning can, the cylinder, because it was spinning fast enough that you were held against the wall instead of falling down due to gravity underneath you. Now, you could apply that same technique to an imaginary big titanium ball, say about, 8 feet in diameter. And inside that ball is another ball about 7.5 feet in diameter. And let's say that there are ball bearings filling that gap between these two balls, so they can never get close to each other to touch, but they can spin within each other. So you got one ball inside of another ball, separated inside by a bunch of little ball bearings. Now, place yourself inside that inner ball, strapped into the ball like you're in that cylinder at the fair, but you're strapped in so that your body is kind of curved forward and sideways as well inside that sphere. And now then throw that ball, a set of balls, off of a 50-story building, let it impact the ground below. Assuming that the metals made that make the balls will not deform from falling 50 feet, when that ball, a group of balls, hits the ground, you're on the inside. Instead of splat, what's going to happen is your inertia is going to spin you in that inner ball very rapidly, and you're going to get heavier against the. You'll be pressed back against the wall of the sphere you're tied to inside of it, like that cylinder at the fair. But you will be pressed against there at, say, maybe 4 or 5 G's gravities for maybe 4 or 5 minutes, and that will allow you to not be killed and not be broken, because you're amortizing or stretching out your sudden stop at the bottom of that 50-story fall. You're stretching that out over several minutes, and several minutes, like if it were 5 minutes, it'd be 300 times. You take 300 times at least the amount of time to stop that you would if you just jumped off and hit splat, like a human would if they jumped off a 50-story building. So this is explaining basically how spinning atoms and the field and the craft amortize the inertial forces over a longer period of time to you inside the craft, while it looks to be a very microscopic period of time to people outside the craft. You'll also notice in a lot of UFO reports of craft like this that there's a brilliant flash of light as they turn that corner. It gets bright and it flashes bright and then goes on. This is the change in energy density around the field just as they turn the corner and blow off some energy. So does that kind of answer the question?
Yeah. And
well said.
So do you attribute then a lot of these sightings then as coming from technology that was developed here on this planet then?
Well, since the late, probably since the early 60s, yes, I would say there was a growing number of them that were man-made. However, this doesn't explain those that occurred in 1895 over Texas. It doesn't explain those that occurred in the Grecian Wars. It doesn't explain those that were reported by the Egyptians, flying shields, and the Greeks as well. Those were here before we were, and they are, I'm sure, part of the group that the Hebrew speaks of, the Elohim, that created mankind as it is today. They're having their own war in the heavens where they live, in a parallel universe, as far as I can understand the Hebrew. And so their craft and those people probably account for more of them today than our own, certainly for all of them before we developed any kind of technology in the 60s.
So with that spinning technology, is that what you were kind of explaining on the inside of some of these crafts, then is what is the counterforce that makes them operate? Are you following what I'm saying?
Not quite. You have to talk into your mic just a bit.
Okay, is the... On the craft that you were talking about creating as a vehicle to get around on this on the Earth at this point in time, you had some kind of a rod or something of that sort on the inside of the craft?
I see what you're saying. I'm pretty sure that this was tried in the plasma craft to start with. And that's why they would turn horizontally rather than, you know, flip vertically and that kind of stuff. But those things were not too reliable because they did suffer structural fatigue. When you go to an electrogravitic craft, you don't have a spinning thing inside of it as far as like a cylinder or a sphere. It's the field itself that that goes through everything. It spins your atoms, and it creates this central vortex that you're part of. So although you can't exactly see it, you can see the effects of it in the air. In fact, in daylight, depending upon how fast it rises up from, you know, sitting on the ground, you can actually see circular rainbows follow behind it for a brief second because it bends the air as it passes with these fields. But no, there's no solid thing spinning. It's really just the field itself.
Okay.
In fact, it parallels what Nikola Tesla did in his polyphase egg experiments, except it does it slightly differently.
Now, was Nikola Tesla involved in the Philadelphia experiment? You mentioned something about Townsend Brown and...
Yeah, I talked to Townsend before he died, and we exchanged a few bits of information. In fact, his laboratory was broken up and sold off to collectors after I went over with my film crew, and we had him unlock it. It was secretly held underground in Salem. And by hook or crook and a few connections, I was able to find out where it was, we filmed that. And in fact, I've got somewhere out there in the video world is something called the Cosmic Conspiracy video with Stan Deo talking about Nikola Tesla and whatever. And in that, we have segments of the film I took inside Townsend Brown's original lab with the Bonson Corporation before it was broken up. And as far as his participation in the Philadelphia experiment, Townsend told me that a lot of his participation had been exaggerated by various authors. You know who they were anyway. And that although he was in the materials control there at the time, that he was not in charge of the effects that occurred as far as the Philadelphia experiment has been related. Now, the Philadelphia experiment did occur. I don't think that Tesla was involved in it. He could have been because the technology required tuned circuits, and I have a 1972 circuit diagram of the mine the magnetic mine chip that they used to like the one that was in the Philadelphia experiment to change the magnetic field around the ship so that it didn't appear to be there to magnetic mines or buoys that the Germans had set in the ocean. I have that circuit, and I know why they used that particular type of naval vessel, because the Manhattan Project was soaking up, you know, the billions of dollars that they needed to make atom bombs. They couldn't get funding for this project like they wanted, and so they had to do it on a shoestring. And by taking this minesweeper and modifying the three-axis coils that they had there with state-of-the-art equipment that they had back then, they were able to generate this self-contained vortexual magnetic field. And it went beyond what Einstein had forecast, and it started to stack energy instead of radiating it out, where it started to stack at a certain point, curl back on itself, and form this kind of spherical field around the craft. And time did dilate for them. They started to go fast time inside there, and to the outside observer, they just blinked out. Inside, they were trapped and going slow, but outside, they looked like they just blinked away. And they went several hundred miles back to their berth in the ocean in this altered time or altered energy density field. I was asked by a member of the Atomic Energy Commission board in England, Dr. Frederick Tatford, in writing by phone, for me to explain what I thought occurred in the Philadelphia experiment. And so I wrote a long letter and explained it, and he wrote back to me and said, okay, you understand completely. And I didn't tell you this. You got it through your own intuition or what information you got. He said, but I want to tell you, understand it. That's what did happen. And what I've related to you basically is a short summary of how the Philadelphia experiment occurred. It was an accident. They were trying to bend radar, but they bent visible light as well. And magnetic field associated with it did create some really strange effects inside the field.
You think that they, I mean, don't you think that they've again, since then tried to do that again?
Well, these saucer craft are an example of that.
Okay, all right.
They're much better controlled now. Once they knew what they were doing.
Okay, so that was a prelude then to
yep.
these. Okay, all right. You get into these. You have a book called The Vindicator Scrolls.
I do.
And what?
It's out of print right now. We've only got just a few copies. I think about 20 copies of their collector's edition here left, but. They're available somewhere out there. I saw people asking $500 a copy on the internet the other day.
Wow.
Yeah, I wish I could charge that. No.
Well, we'll
probably redo it one of these days. I just haven't had time to reprint it.
Because you had like a book, was one called The Alien Presence and then The Vindicator Scrolls?
No, The Cosmic Conspiracy and
okay.
The Vindicator Scrolls.
Okay.
And there's two. There's the Cosmic Conspiracy Millennium and then just the Cosmic Conspiracy, correct?
Well, there were, oh gosh, I forget. I think I went through three editions of it. The Millennium Edition has an addendum to the original 200 pages. And the reason is I have a code in the book that I put in there so that words on had to be on certain pages. And so I never change the first 200 pages, even a new edition. I add stuff at the tail end, extra pages, but I'll never change the 200 pages or screw up the coding. But and that coding basically was injected in there to tell the Illuminists, the Wiccans, the Masons, and everybody else that I mentioned in there that I knew enough about what they were doing and their inside coding to say certain things to them in their language. That's why it's the first 200 pages never changed. But we've gone through, oh gosh, I don't know, 15, 16 printings. There's been over 250,000 of them sold in 22 countries that I know about. And we've got some being printed in German now. And I think even a group in Greece are doing Koine Greek. So, yeah, I'm out of stock of it. But that Millennium Edition is the most recent, and it has... In the added section I put in there, a discussion, in essence, trying to show people why the Illuminists did what they did in the late 40s, the reasoning, and, you know, how it went bad, but they had good intentions, but it just went bad.
In regard to some of the magnetic areas that happened, how much is magnetic energy responsible for earthquakes?
I don't know the answer to that. I know that we have tremendous earth currents of electricity spinning around under the surface of the earth, and these are properly termed telluric, T-E-L-L-U-R-I-C, telluric earth currents. And those currents are so powerful, the electricity and the magnetic component of them, that they actually steer cloud formations and storms up above the earth, you know, through the mantle. Their effect makes thunderstorms and lightning, you know, go where it goes. So the magnetic field is important in that it helps, distribute heat through the planet. When we get hit by a coronal mass ejection or heavy plasma ball from the sun, that energy bounces around inside the planet by following the magnetic field into the pole, the nearest pole. And I've seen it on my thermal maps that I used to get from the Navy. The sea surface temperature maps show that for at least 24, maybe 36 hours, that hot energy ball bounces around inside the planet and appears changing sea surface temperatures in a radius of about, 600 miles in diameter wherever it bounces. So the magnetic field is important to a lot of things. I'm probably selling it short, but very important.
I mean, I don't know much about this, but is that possibly why the magma in that inside the Earth gets so warm? Is it absorbing that energy?
Well, when it happens, yeah, but we don't get coronal mass ejections all the time. I mean, they're rare events, or fairly rare. They're not frequent enough to be adding the appreciable energy there. If anything, the Earth is cooling down, and you will find that W.G. Owen in Dr. Owen in London has a book out on the continental drift theory, showing that the Earth has actually increased in diameter between 20% and 25% since its original cooling state. And a number of planets, in fact, probably every planet, starts out at a certain diameter, very small compared to where it finishes up. As it ages, it expands, and that magma inside starts to cool as it expands. Now, have you ever seen a geode? Are you talking
mm-hmm.
about?
Yes.
Okay. You know how a geode has those crystals growing inside of it?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Planets, we are reasonably certain, do the same thing. As they age, the mass starts to cool, and it forms crystals, mountainous, huge crystals pointing toward the core of the Earth like a geode. And when a planet finally dies and breaks up, of course, these crystalline structures are attached to the surface and get splattered out into space or whatever. On Mars, there is growing evidence that the quote-unquote face of Mars near Cydonia was created by a planetoid or a moon that was in the asteroid belt, which is a bunch of fragments of something that was there once before, a planet or a group, a planet and star and moons. It's all broken up. And with a diameter of approximately 300 to 400 miles, something had crystallized inside of a planetoid that size and impacted to the east of Cydonia, and there's a great fan, like a wedge shape, of where it unrolled the surface of this thing as it impacted and laid out the surface inverted, like you'd take an orange and turn it inside out. And that made these pyramid-shaped crystalline structures appear as though they were pyramids made by some intelligence. And then, of course, all the red dust that came from this encounter and from the debris that came out of the asteroid belt before it was an asteroid belt coated the surface of Mars in many places with this red dust, which is not native to the planet. That's why a lot of the water is to be found deeper in the planet, because of this impact and the debris and stuff that settled down and coated much of the surface of Mars. So, anyway,
now,
that's just an aside. But
on your website, I mean, you have all kinds of pictures of the Earth through earthquake zones and different, like pictures of Mars and do you want to explain that a little bit? Katie.
I'm trying to figure out. There's quite a big site.
Yes, it is.
You mean earthquake predictions? Or
earthquake predictions, and then you have a lot of different, I don't know if it's government, weather.
Okay. Well, mm-hmm. I put links into various government-supplied data centers, which tell people variations in, the ice at the polar caps, sea levels, sea surface temperatures, solar anomalies, sunspot activity, I think we might have on there someplace a link to the Hubble Telescope Photograph Library, which is really quite fascinating in a number of ways. But those are just sites that I've used, and I put them up for people to share. I haven't really done much of that since about November of 2006, when we lost our data stream from the U.S. Navy at Monterey in California. I was using the data to forecast earthquakes with about 70% accuracy, about 5 to 6 days ahead of time.
Mm-hmm.
But once that data stream was not any longer publicly available, I couldn't do it anymore. I was able to do it for 11 years, but when they closed it off, I couldn't find a replacement that had the same data. So I tell people where to go and look and amuse themselves with these various things, and Holly puts up everything on the site daily now, the news and stuff for us. And I don't get involved with it too much because I'm just up to my eyeballs with engineering problems with the saucer craft and ways to take wind energy and convert it into electricity without all the moving parts and motors and stuff they're using now.
So. Well, for anybody listening out there, Stan Deo's site is just wonderful, and I encourage everybody to go out and take a look. Would you give him your website name?
Sure. It goes mainly by standeo.com. That's S-T-A-N-D-E-Y-O.com. In the early days, we used to call it the Millennium and then a hyphen arc.net. And if you use that address, it'll get to the same place. But we made it easier because if people could spell my name, they could find the site and start navigating, standeo.com. And if you go there, Holly's got another site that's underneath that, and you go to it on the left by pressing preparedness. And you'll go to a huge, huge website of all kinds of free information there to help you prepare for various things that are happening and going to happen. And how to prepare for nuclear and biological warfare at home without spending heaps of dough. And then, of course, she has the news section she puts up with news that is pertinent to our well-being as Americans and to a degree as citizens of Earth. But obviously, we're more concerned with the effect it'll have on Americans because that's where we live.
How soon do you think you might be able to have some kind of a working machine?
A craft?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think we're probably, if I stopped everything else I'm doing right now in the business, which has been somewhat chaotic, I could have a craft in the air in 6 weeks. It'd only be about 22 inches in diameter because of our budget, but it'll be remote control, and eventually we'll have stereo vision in the cockpit so that our pilots can wear glasses down here that they can fly real time as though they were in the craft to learn how to fly the man-sized one later. We're building a small one so that if we crash them, it doesn't hurt anybody. But it's all designed, it's all ready, all the templates and stuff are being cut, the flat parts of it over in Oklahoma, and we'll be making the spherical or saucer-shaped parts here in Colorado. Those are all designed, and we're having some special tooling made to turn those off on lathes. So, as I say, earliest date would be 6 weeks. It's probably going to be more like 3 months, unless I can just steal some time from some other project to get back onto it.
Do you think there's other people doing anything similar along those lines?
I don't know. There were quite a few people in the projects. Most of us kind of knew how it worked. There was a trick, a couple of tricks to make it work really well as an aircraft. But I think anybody that's been involved in the propulsion with the electrovitic would know how to know what to look for and do.
And did you ever
I
get?
Hope they are.
Did you get to experience seeing one or being around one or?
Oh, I've seen the assembly of the craft in the assembly areas and the coils and. You know, cross sections cut of it so that I could see inside how the coils were wound, and I never got to ride in one, but I suppose that's my fondest wet dream is to fly one of them. But, figuring I probably won't be invited to get on such a thing these days, I'd have to make my own, which is one of the reasons I'm doing this. I hope we'll be able to make it using such low power that eventually we can let a person add pedal power to it, you know, like a quarter horsepower engine from your body, and actually get away from having to use too much gasoline to fly these things.
And what about the wind?
Well, the wind is good. have you ever heard the story about the salmon, there's a certain type of trout in Europe that Schauberger spoke of that can swim up a waterfall by holding perfectly still?
Mm-hmm.
Have you heard of that?
I have.
Okay. That particular species of trout has a way to manipulate its gills and its fins to form a water vortex like we're doing with the air here. And it takes the oncoming water falling down from that waterfall takes the energy of that and forms this curling, smoke ring-shaped vortex of water circulating through its mouth and its gills and its fins, so that it pulls itself up, tacking straight into the flow of water. It'd be like taking a sailboat, having a headwind, and getting sucked forward into the headwind because of the way you set your sails. And that's what these crafts can do. And so would the wind bother us? You know, at low energy levels it could, but if you store energy in the field like we hope to, as soon as you get a headwind, it'll pull you forward. You'll just climb right up it. It'd be like taking a miniature one of these and turning on a water faucet and putting a miniature one under the water faucet and having it suck itself up to the faucet.
Okay, and then the wind energy machine you were talking about, where are you in that design?
Sorry, just speak.
The wind energy machine you were talking about, where are you in that design?
Well, I've got the circuits here on my desk at the moment. I'm looking at generating a version of a Lord Kelvin's water drop experiment, which will let air pass through various collectors at 30, 40, 50, 60 miles an hour, or even slower. And it will generate high voltage charges between these, like rings, I guess is the best way to say. And that will discharge across to a voltage regulator and charge batteries or run a DC motor. And so I can probably prove the concept within 3 or 4 weeks with some plastic tubing and some aluminum foil and a little bit of insulating paint and some high voltage wires and stuff like that. So once I've got the concept working and know the parameters, then we can look toward building one that will supply power for the house. It doesn't have any moving parts except the wind.
No, that's not related anything to the circular thing you had displayed in your video.
No.
Okay.
No. Well, of all the things that you are aware of right now, Stan, what would you like our listeners to know?
Wow. I don't know. I certainly would advise people to stock up on extra foodstuffs that they that will store for and keep for a year at a time or so, and get some Clorox, which doesn't have soap or you know, like detergent added to it, just pure Clorox to purify water in case you need to take some brack water to drink, because I think we're going to be short for water and food here shortly. And I would certainly be looking at putting my 401k to better use in those areas than just sitting in the market or in bonds or whatever at the moment, because our dollar is going to be worthless very shortly. So,
do you have any kind of inside information onto that, or is that just by observing?
Very good question.
Yeah, I'm trying to separate the two in my mind. I do have information sources. Some are reliable, some are not. Some have vested interests, you know, at heart. Let's say that it's a combination of all those things that you, or both the things you said. If you do look at the world currency market, you will see that we're on a slope of decline against the strength of the euro. And at some point, when the dollar falls beneath about 68, 69 cents against it, it's when we start the slide that we cannot recover from, and the dollar will just crash. And that's close. We're very close to that. So I'm not an economist, but from what I've read of other people who are more qualified, that point, that magic number, is where we lose control of the dollar. And if they rewrite the oil contracts in the Middle East in the euro instead of the U.S. dollar, we're done. And there's growing tensions between Iran and Israel and Syria. And should Israel make a preemptive nuclear strike on Damascus or on Iran, This could probably turn world opinion against the United States, having backed Israel, and Israel, of course. And at that point, the oil contracts may be rewritten in the euro or some other standard, but not the American dollar, in retaliation. And this is a real and present danger this year.
And is that by design? I mean, is somebody trying to break the American dollar?
Yeah, probably. Probably the Arab Consortium, if anybody. But most of the terrorism that we have to deal with comes out of Iran or Iran-based groups. And they state their purpose. They want to disappear Israel. They want to disappear the United States because we've been their backers, their protectors. So Israel is going to be forced. Iran, Ahmadinejad is supplying stuff, nuclear stuff, to Syria. I think they're probably stockpiling it in Damascus, which is why Damascus probably get burned to the ground. But Damascus is so close to Israel that they could virtually take a slingshot and put a nuke over into northern Israel, so over the Galilee, or the Golan Heights, so into the Galilee. So they're going to have to make a preemptive strike before very long, and the intelligence sources say this year, later part of the year. When that happens, we're going to be in real trouble.
So how long have you been recommending or having your site set up for preparation?
Since 1999.
So did that have something to do with the millennium?
We mentioned that, but this was beyond that. We're talking about apocalyptic things, not the millennium bug or whatever it was.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, no.
Okay.
We were aware of it. We made preparations in our own computer and software and various things, but it was not a major influence, no.
And so it didn't affect your business that much?
No.
Okay. Okay.
Not at all.
Okay.
Mind you, we were sitting on a farm, self-sufficient down in Australia at that time.
Okay. All right.
We could shut the doors for a year, and with the livestock and wells and dams and stuff we had, we didn't have to open the gates for a year at a time.
Wow. So,
what encouraged you to move to Colorado?
Well, I'm going to tell you what happened. I had some dream visions that were absolutely astounding, and they pointed to a place here and showed me a name and a vision of the place. The Beulah Valley, seen from the window where we are here now. And it was so strong that I convinced Holly. We flew back and from Australia and looked around to find that place and found it, and just as advertised in the dreams. And went back, put our farm on the market, sold it, and flew back here and bought this place.
Yeah, it's a beautiful
valley.
Well, that was
after I got permission from the State Department to come back. Before that, I was having I tell the story, but I leave out the names of the people because they're still alive and functioning, and I certainly don't want to irritate them because they helped me.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we're awfully glad you're here in Colorado.
I tell you what, I loved Colorado. When I came up here to the academy for a couple of years from Texas, I fell in love with the place, and Holly lived here. Gosh, before I met her for 15 years or so. It's just a beautiful, beautiful state. Love it. I know it's got a lot of strange weather and things like that, but that's part of the fun of it, I think.
It's part of its charm, because you can have all four seasons in a day.
Yes. Absolutely charming.
Yeah.
Well, this charming has cost us a little bit this week. We've put in air conditioners to the swampers because it's so humid that the heat just makes it unbearable, so we put in air conditioning for the first time. Do you swampers where you are air conditioning, Katie?
Well, I don't really need it here where I am. I have a brick house,
and
it stays very, very cool. But in Pueblo, definitely you need an air conditioner or a swamp cooler because it's smothering.
Are you familiar with Pueblo West?
Yes.
Yeah. They didn't tell us that in the little brochures when we bought this house. I bought this house because it was the one that I was shown, right? But the real estate guy forgot to tell me about the wind.
Yeah, they have horrible winds out there.
They should rename this cobweb blow with.
It's true. And I have seen some bumper stickers like that in the Pueblo area, you know, because it'll literally throw gravel at you as you're walking across it.
Well, look, we've had, you know what a dusto was, don't you, a little dry tornado?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I looked out here a couple summers ago. I looked out the window to the south of the house, out of the kitchen, and I saw the wind blowing about on the edge of our property out probably a few hundred feet, blowing, let's say, east. Mm-hmm. And then I went up to the front door and out and looked to the north, and I saw the wind there blowing the trees just a few hundred feet north of our property to the west.
Yeah.
I thought, oh, that's odd. It's blowing the opposite direction on the north side of the house than it is on the south side. Then I went and looked out to the west, and it was blowing to the south. And I realized we were in the middle of one of those big dust devils, and our house was sitting right in the middle of it.
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah, great as stuff. A child, we used to go play in the dirt devils.
It
used to be great fun just to go out and spin in them.
Okay, Stan.
You know,
go ahead.
I was in the middle of one of those. Holly and I both were on the second mesa when I was visiting the one of the elderly elders up on his mesa up near the edge. We were a few hundred feet above the floor of the desert. And
was this the Hopi?
Yeah, the Hopi, okay. Yeah. And it was the one I was talking to was the assistant to the elderly elder, and they, I was talking to him about prophecy, and they were talking to me about prophecy to a point. They wouldn't tell me a lot of things, he said, because I didn't have my tribal third name, and you know, unless I'd been initiated to the tribe, I couldn't know these secrets. And Holly's standing to my right about, 10 feet, and I was talking to this Indian fellow, well-educated university guy, and I didn't want to be rude, so I took off my sunglasses because he was standing with the sun at his back, and it was in my eyes. And so I put my glasses in my pocket, and I realized I was having to squint to see him because it's so bright, and he wasn't moving or anything to help me. So I knelt down in his shadow to talk to him, looked up at him, and while I was talking to him, you know, and saying, "Look, well, what can you tell me about what your prophecies are?" "Well, not much," he said, and I was doodling in the dirt between us with a stick, and I, you know how a doodle, you draw a spiral or squares or circles or something. I drew a spiral, and as I did, I finally thought, this is killing my knees, I'm going to stand up. And so I stand up, and I was talking to him, and this dirt devil formed around Holly. And it was a ripper. And it formed around her and then swung over and put this Indian fellow and I right in the middle of it. And it wouldn't go away. And it was throwing sand in our eyes and rocks at us and stuff. And both of us, being macho, was not about to move. And we were squinting, looking at each other, this thing just spinning around us like that. And I looked down just on a whim, and I saw that spiral thing I'd drawn in the dirt, and he'd seen it too. And I wiped it out with my foot. And as I wiped with my foot, the dirt devil stopped immediately. And he said, however, there are some things we can tell you now. And then because I had written or scrawled in the sand their most sacred symbol, Sipapu, that spiral, and that's another whole story. And then the dust devil came, and then when I wiped it out, the dust devil stopped. He thought it was a sign. So then they told me some interesting things. So dust devils are interesting in my life.
Yeah, they're kind of magical.
Yeah, they are.
Well, Stan, I really want to thank you for coming on our program. You've enlightened us in numerous ways, and I really hope that we could have you up again just to see how you come along with your vehicle. And energy?
A wind generator to make high voltage electricity.
Okay, all right.
Yeah. We need something like that because solar's not getting it the way they're using it now, and these wind generators are too expensive and noisy. And
okay.
No, we've got to have a better way. That's why we're trying to do it.
Well, thank you very much for your contribution, Stan. It's just been wonderful to visit with you, and you've really added quality to our lives. Thank you.
Well, I hope so. Anyway, it's been fun talking to you, ladies.
Okay, well, thank you. Thank you very much. And good night. This is KHEN LP FM 106.9 Salida.